Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Just what we need in this economy, another slowdown in the supply chain. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday, September 12th. Good to have you with us. If you don't happen to live near train tracks, it can be easy to forget just how much cargo in this country moves by rail, about 40% of long-distance freight. And this week, we could all get a big reminder. 8 of the 12 labor unions representing U.S. rail workers have agreed to a tentative contract with railroad carriers. But two big unions are still in the middle of negotiations, pushing for better quality of life provisions like sick and vacation time. If they don't reach a deal by Friday, workers plan to strike. The conflict is already slowing down trade, though. U.S. railroads are stopping shipments of some cargo to prepare for a potential strike, or maybe to gain some leverage during negotiations. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab has more on how all this could affect our already beleaguered supply chains.
We've all learned a little more than we probably ever expected to about supply chains over the last couple years, mostly about ships. Ships treading water at the Port of Los Angeles, a ship stuck in the Suez Canal. Now let's talk trains. Jason Miller is a professor of supply chain management at Michigan State.
Modern supply chains cannot really effectively function without them.
Trains are how goods get from shipping ports to major distribution hubs and vice versa. Around half of what we import and export touches U.S. railways at some point. Because even though they take longer than trucks, trains are cheaper. They cost about a quarter less. And they're good for moving large quantities of goods. Think coal, chemicals, and grains. One train holds somewhere around 240 shipping containers at a time.
That's going to be a lot more efficient than 240 trucks.
Replacing that amount of capacity, I think, is the major challenge.
Willie Shee is a management professor at Harvard. He says there are already major shortages in trucking for drivers and chassis. Those are the wheeled frames that hold the shipping container. If railways suddenly shut down, stuff will get stuck wherever it happens to be.
It's kind of a long-distance traffic jam.
That traffic jam will also affect ocean transport. Gene Graves is executive director of the United Shippers Alliance, an industry group. He says ports can only store so much.
It's just like a parking lot. We're full and we can't unload any more ships.
It means there'd be lots of ships backed up, ships full of clothing, cars, and couches floating in the Pacific Ocean.
Which literally would disrupt the whole supply chain.
And by now we know what happens next. Manufacturing slows down and the cost of goods goes up. The Association of American Railroads says a shutdown could cost $2 billion a day. It's unclear how likely a rail strike is. The last major one was in 1992. The federal government stepped in and forced everyone back to work, and the whole thing lasted 2 days. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, not your usual Monday. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We're going to stay, loosely speaking, with supply chain challenges, because while much of the world has returned to something like business as usual, China continues its zero-tolerance approach to COVID. Right now, some 70 Chinese cities are under partial or full lockdowns, and the restrictions are increasing ahead of the Communist Party Congress next month. It's held every 5 years. Our China correspondent Jennifer Pak joins me now to talk about what's going on. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, Amy.
Can you start by telling us the difference between a full and a partial lockdown? So a partial lockdown means an office block, a condo, or entire districts could be sealed off if someone with COVID, their contacts' contacts, happen to pass through. A full lockdown these days with the Omicron variant means even food deliveries are stopped. But this is where you're getting stories from cities currently under lockdown complaining that they're going hungry.
Wow. And Jennifer, you've not only reported on life under lockdown, you've actually lived this when Shanghai was locked down for 2 months. Can you talk about what it was like just trying to get food?
Yeah, it was surreal because I had the money. I just couldn't get what I wanted when I wanted it. So at one point, I paid $188 for a box of Italian cured meats because there was bacon in it. But then, of course, they messed up the order and I was able to snack on gourmet salami, but no bacon. Mm-hmm. There was a convenience shop owner nearby me who ate nothing but instant noodles for weeks. And then the next question is, you know, when you get the food, how long do you make it last for? How do you make it last? And that's the thing. Nobody told us when it was going to end.
Well, just given all that, how are people holding up? I mean, are you seeing any resistance to these seemingly never-ending lockdowns?
We're seeing spots of it, but it's really tough to say nationally because of the very sophisticated censorship. I mean, we're only just finding out now that there are places still in lockdown for well over a month in the Xinjiang region. People couldn't go to the hospitals for treatment for non-COVID related stuff. I mean, there was a joke, although not quite funny, that in the US, COVID is not an illness, but in China, only COVID is an illness.
Hmm. Because people have actually died from lack of medical care, I've read.
Yeah, and pregnant women have miscarried because they didn't have the right PCR test to get into the hospital.
Well, for the economy, these lockdowns have obviously been extremely disruptive. What does this ongoing situation mean going forward?
Well, it means that China's reforms to shift the economy from an export-led one to a consumption-based one has stalled. The zero COVID policy, no doubt in the beginning, really helped Chinese factories get back up and running. I was back at the office within 2 months in Shanghai. And these factories, by the way, were able to churn out stuff for people here in the U.S. and the rest of the world when everything else was shut down. So that was good. But for Chinese consumers, it's now 2.5 years going on 3, and they're very reluctant to spend. All of their savings have depleted. And right now, COVID restrictions are ramping up.
With so many cities facing either full or partial lockdown, it's got to affect the global supply chain.
Absolutely. And that's why there are companies like Apple reportedly wanting to boost production elsewhere, say in India or Southeast Asia, which have already opened. Now, keep in mind, every city that has emerged from an Omicron lockdown like Shanghai, they're not the same. I mean, we have to consistently test at least every second day. And there's that uncertainty about quarantine. And the worst of all, there is no off-ramp for this.
Jennifer Pack is China correspondent for Marketplace. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Amy.
We're going to take a little detour into the weeds of commerce for a moment. Did you know that when a credit card company processes a payment, they use different codes to signify different kinds of retailers? There's a code for pet supply stores, another one for florists. And for years now, there's been pressure on the financial industry to create a unique merchant category code for stores that sell guns and ammunition to make it easier to flag suspicious sales. Late last week, Amalgamated Bank announced that it had applied for and received just such a code from an international global standards body. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes has more on what that means.
Since we started using credit cards about 70 years ago, gun and ammunition merchants have been put under the category of miscellaneous, which also includes map stores, magic shops, places that sell mostly ice. Lisa Ellis studies payments at the equity research firm Moffitt Nathanson.
Digital payments are increasingly widely used and have been more frequently used for actually purchasing guns. I think historically that would have been a purchase that was often just made in cash.
The idea behind introducing this unique code for gun retailers is to help the financial services industry spot suspicious activity so it can report it to the Treasury Department. Catherine Judge studies financial regulation as a law professor at Columbia.
There's been work done showing that before a lot of the mass shootings, the shooters involved oftentimes bought a significant number of firearms within just a few weeks of when the shooting occurred. And so there's the hope that you could identify those patterns of behavior.
And maybe even stop a shooting before it occurs. Judge points out banks and credit card companies have a long history of flagging legal transactions that might be indicators of illegal activity. She says for this to actually work, there needs to be a system to filter through those red flags.
As actually, there really is something here that's suspicious, and then turned over to the FBI or local law enforcement in a timely way. And those are mechanisms that don't yet exist.
Judge says the financial industry actually tends to overreport, which means there could be more data going to the Treasury Department than it's prepared to deal with. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
We've spent a lot of time lately, as one does here at Marketplace, poring over the most recent Beige Book from the Federal Reserve. That's the name of the central bank's regular report on how things are going in this economy for businesses, consumers, nonprofits. There's a nationwide snapshot, plus regional reports from each of the 12 Federal Reserve districts. Always interesting reading, seriously. And one thing we kept seeing in those regional reports out last week, food banks are seeing more and more clients, and food insecurity is on the rise, in large part because of inflation. From our bureau in Portland, Oregon, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has that story.
Things were actually looking up last year, food security-wise. Unemployment was low and paychecks were rising. So fewer people than earlier in the pandemic were coming to local food banks for help. But that changed this spring, says Oregon Food Bank CEO Susanna Morgan.
We are the canary in the coal mine for what is happening for low-income folks in our community.
And what is happening is inflation. The nonprofit is on track to serve 1.5 million individuals and families this year, about 25% more than last year, and nearly double the number before the pandemic.
When your income is too little to pay for housing, to pay for healthcare, to pay for your transportation, the easiest thing to ask for is help with food. It's much harder to get help with rent, energy, to get a new job.
This is playing out across the country. Feeding America, a national umbrella organization for food banks, reported a 15% increase in demand in early summer. Economist Jim Sullivan studies poverty at Notre Dame's Lab for Economic Opportunities.
Where we're seeing sharp rise in prices are things like gas prices, food, rent, and necessities that hit the lower income households particularly hard.
In July, the cost of food at grocery stores was up 13% year over year, the biggest jump since 1979. And that's taking a toll, says Bankrate financial analyst Greg McBride.
Look at the savings balances that had been accumulated during the pandemic. Those are declining. Credit card balances, which had declined during the pandemic, now rising again.
At the Oregon Food Bank's sprawling central warehouse in Portland, forklifts load pallets of soup, applesauce, milk, and fresh vegetables. Spokesman Jason Stefani says most of it's purchased in bulk with government funds and charitable donations.
So our scale is huge, but the cost of food is rising. It definitely has an impact even on us.
One example, a tractor trailer full of peanut butter that cost $34,000 before the pandemic now runs well over $40,000. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Coming up,
we're kind of the Ally Sheedy of the Breakfast Club.
But without all the dandruff, right? First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 229 points, 0.7%, to close at 32,381. The NASDAQ found 154 points, 1.3%, to finish at 12,226. And the S&P 500 lifted 43 points, just over 1%, and at 4110. We heard from Kristen Schwab about that potential railway strike, looking at some railroad stocks. CSX Corporation was up 0.6%. Union Pacific steamed ahead nearly 1%. Norfolk Southern rose 0.3%. Stephanie Hughes reported that firearm stores will now have a merchant code that would help track gun purchases using credit cards. Looking at some credit card companies, Visa, MasterCard, and Discover all rose about 0.7%. You're listening to Marketplace.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. We'll get the latest reading on inflation tomorrow when the Consumer Price Index comes out for August. One way people are paying for the higher prices we've been seeing is through buy now, pay later services. You've surely seen the options at the store checkout or when you're shopping online from companies like Affirm, Klarna, or Afterpay. Why pay up front when you can make 4 interest-free installments, usually every 2 weeks? Well, as Emily Stewart wrote recently in Vox, there are some good reasons.
They do say, you know, it's a 0% loan. You pay it back and everybody ends happy. Obviously, if you miss a payment, you get hit with a late fee, or you miss a payment and suddenly it dings your credit. And there is evidence that people miss payments quite often. And I think another thing to know about these things is that merchants that are selling, you know, whatever the product is, they pay a higher fee to buy now, pay later companies than, let's say, a credit card. But you buy more stuff when you're doing buy now, pay later because it feels like you're spending less money. So maybe that $100 would hurt, but if it feels like you can pay for it $25 over a few months, it doesn't hurt as much and you don't think about it as much.
Right. And with the economy pretty strong, despite inflation, you know, most people who want a job have one. Pay has been rising, not as fast. But I wonder what happens if this kind of payment plan has grown in popularity when the economy turns.
Right. And that's certainly a concern. And you've seen some of the valuations of these companies coming down as these concerns start to rise among their investors who are saying, wait a minute, how many people aren't going to actually be able to pay you back? Because what happens with a lot of these companies is they do a soft credit check, or they don't look super hard at whether or not you're going to be able to pay this back. And so what happens? They wind up with more and more consumers who are maybe doing loan stacking, and they have 5, 6, 7 different of these buy now, pay later loans. These companies don't know, and they don't know that they are dealing with consumers that can't pay them back.
What do we know about people who use these services and their credit quality, so to speak?
I mean, we do know that they tend to be younger. A lot of them are people of color. Some of them have subprime credit. And what buy now, pay later business will tell you is that they're offering financial inclusion, right? They're sending credit to people who couldn't get that elsewhere. But it's not entirely clear how much that's the case. One study from TransUnion found that buy now, pay later customers tend to have more credit products. So these are people who are taking out a lot of lines of credit. And maybe people who are a little bit in over their head sometimes just because they're not quite thinking about what they're doing. It's really tempting. Like, I was at the doctor's office last week And I got an offer to pay in 4 installments from my doctor. At the doctor, which was wild.
Wow.
Like, I'd never in my life seen anything like it. And it was attractive. And it was a second where I was like, oh, maybe I could do it. I don't need to do it. But you can see where you can kind of get swept up in this pretty quickly. And like I said before, there really is evidence that people buy more things when they have this option.
It's interesting you saw this at the doctor's office. I've also seen reports that more people are using Buy Now, Pay Later for things like groceries, at restaurants. I mean, are you seeing a shift in how people are using this when they shop for not just, you know, things they want, but things they need?
Right. Well, especially as prices do go up and you do see people start to struggle to spend on basics, you know, we are going to start seeing people pay more with credit cards, or if you do get the buy now, pay later option to pay with that. I mean, there is an extent where we are generally seeing household balance sheets hold up pretty decently. But as prices rise, especially if there is a recession on the horizon, people are going to become more stretched. And so inevitably, you're going to see people putting more things on credit cards, using Buy Now, Pay Later, if and when they can, just to get the basics.
As you write, regulators are starting to pay more attention to these companies. This Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is looking into several of them. What are the concerns?
I mean, I think a lot of the concern here is really just, you know, there's really a tough line between what's predatory and what's progressive. And the experts that I talked to, you know, kind of said the jury's still out on these things, on whether they're good, they're bad. And this is just really a regulatory gray area where eventually the regulators will probably catch up. The question right now is what happens in the meantime until they do, and what happens if people really start to get into trouble with a bunch of loans that they maybe shouldn't have been able to take out in the first place.
All right. Emily Stewart wrote about Buy Now, Pay Later at Vox. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
The international logistics business has been an interesting one in recent years, what with the aforementioned supply chain issues related to the pandemic, the war in Ukraine, and the ongoing U.S.-China trade conflict. The Biden administration said earlier this month it's keeping tariffs in place on hundreds of billions of dollars of Chinese imports, first imposed by the Trump administration, pending a review. Seems like a good time to check back in with Gretchen Blau. She's a customs broker at Logistics Plus in Erie, Pennsylvania, meaning she helps clients navigate the process of importing and exporting goods. Here she is with an update.
Things have calmed down as much as they ever do for us. We know a fixed date of when freight is arriving now. Before, it was a little unpredictable because of all the port delays. We have happy clients, so it's just good for everyone. We're having a lot of clients that sign up for, you know, our third-party logistics service, and we're part of that. So there's been an increase in that with providing 3PL services. It's one phone call that they need to make to us. You know, they don't have to call a separate customs broker. They don't have to call a separate trucking company overseas. Just one-stop shopping. We've hired two people to our team. The last person we hired had actually applied for an accounting position. And I thought, well, she takes good attention to detail. Customs kind of takes a special kind of person. You know, they have to be able to make sure that the paperwork looks good, that all the weights and the values are correct. We have a meme of the Breakfast Club, and we're kind of the more nerdy person on the we're kind of the Ally Sheedy of the Breakfast Club. I can take more time to get new customers set up, to talk to new potential customers. It just makes my life a whole heck of a lot easier to have a good growing team that is looking to expand our business and looking to learn new things. normal is a relative phrase in the logistics industry, especially international logistics. We're affected by weather, we're affected by the economy, fuel prices, that type of thing. So it's always kind of in flux, but we're not seeing the delays and whatnot like we used to with the pandemic. So things are getting better, things are getting more normal, but like I said, always in flux.
That was Gretchen Blau, a.k.a. Ali Chidi, customs broker at Logistics Plus in Erie, Pennsylvania. This final note on the way out today, U.S. banknotes will soon bear the signature of the first woman Treasury Secretary. Though Janet Yellen took office in 2021, rules dictated that her signature couldn't actually be printed on U.S. currency until President Biden appointed a U.S. Treasurer. Different role. Today, that treasurer was sworn in another first. Len Malerba is the first Native American to hold the office, overseeing the U.S. Mint and the Bureau of Engraving and Printing. Malerba is chief of the Mohegan tribe. Her signature will also appear on U.S. bills. Okay, here's your moment of economic context. When it comes to inflation, regular listeners know expectations can matter almost as much as the number itself. And Americans are expecting less of it. The New York Fed said in its August survey, consumers expected prices to climb 5.7% this time next year, down from an expected 6.2% in July. And that's the lowest expected rate since October of last year. Our daily production team includes Anais Amin, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Nicholas Giang, Maria Hollenhorst, Sarah Leeson, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Amy Scott. We will see you tomorrow. This is APM.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.